to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the Sad Moms
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the second podcast episode on perinatal mental health in collaboration with the National Curriculum in Reproductive Psychiatry Obstetrics Group. Today, we will focus on perinatal anxiety, but if you're interested in learning more, the National Curriculum in Reproductive Psychiatry, or NCRP, has online modules about perinatal mental health for classroom and individual learning, as well as extended content designed specifically for obstetrics providers. Check out the NCRP website at ncrptraining.org, which we'll link in the show notes. My name is Jenny Libert. I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner who works in maternal mental health in Utah.
And I'm Dr. Lauren Gimbel, an OBGYN at the University of Utah. In this episode, we'll talk about anxiety in the perinatal time period. The objectives of this episode are to recognize the clinical presentation of generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, panic disorder, and obsessive-compulsive disorder in pregnancy and postpartum, to differentiate clinical anxiety disorders in pregnancy from normal anxiety or worry in pregnancy, to differentiate between generalized anxiety disorder and obsessive-compulsive disorder, to differentiate between obsessive-compulsive disorder and postpartum psychosis, and to gain comfort with initiating treatment, avoiding treatment pitfalls, and when to refer to a specialist. So, Joni, why are we talking about anxiety?
Up to 20% of pregnancies are affected by anxiety disorders. These are treatable disorders from which patients can improve dramatically with appropriate support and intervention. In addition, many women suffer from anxiety symptoms that don't meet the threshold for disorder, but are nevertheless impairing. There's a huge opportunity to improve the screening and treatment process. Also, OCD often presents for the first time in the peripartum period, so we're going to spend some time discussing OCD today, even though it's not technically considered an anxiety disorder.
Women actually have a lifetime prevalence of anxiety disorder that's twice the rate of men. 40% of women will experience an anxiety disorder at some point in their lifetime. And a recent meta-analysis estimated that the prevalence of having at least one anxiety disorder in pregnancy was around 20%, with the trend toward a higher prevalence of anxiety during pregnancy as compared with the postpartum time period.
A systematic review found that the prevalence of perinatal anxiety was the same as or higher than that of anxiety in the general population. This includes general anxiety disorder at 9% and panic disorder at 1% to 2%, as well as disorders with an anxiety component, such as OCD and PTSD. Anxiety disorders are often chronic, and many women enter the perinatal period already having an anxiety disorder.
There are a lot of risk factors for perinatal anxiety, with the largest being a prior diagnosis of either anxiety or depression or other mental health disorders. There's also risk factors such as a family history of psychiatric diagnosis, psychosocial risk factors, like a history of trauma or abuse, intimate partner violence, limited social support, lower educational attainment, and the presence of adverse life events. Additional life stressors such as relationship stress, limited resources, financial concerns, heavy household or family responsibilities, and chronic stress from racial discrimination can also increase the risk of perinatal anxiety. Pregnancy-related factors can also affect risk and include the lack of sleep during pregnancy and postpartum, having more than just one baby, past pregnancy loss, and complications or unexpected birth outcomes. Untreated perinatal generalized anxiety disorder and panic disorder have variable trajectories, onset, and worsening, but the prognosis is worse without treatment. It is associated with less prenatal visits, delayed initiation of care, preterm birth, low birth weight, reduced head circumference, impaired bonding, and a long-lasting impact on children's cognition, social-emotional development, and mental health. Untreated OCD is associated with impaired mother-infant bonding, lower rates of breastfeeding, and a risk of not being as responsive to the infant due to presumed factors of fear or from obsessions and compulsions or comorbid depression.
Let's switch over to pathophysiology. Perinatal anxiety is multidimensional with biological, pregnancy-related, and psychosocial factors. In addition, there is a complex relationship between anxiety and stress mediated by alterations in the maternal HPA axis, epigenetics, mitochondrial dysfunction, and immune system activation. Most anxiety symptoms are mediated by the autonomic, particularly the sympathetic nervous system. The neurotransmitters thought to be most involved are norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, and GABA. Other factors like sleep deprivation, immune system function, and a tendency toward perfectionism or hyper-responsibility can increase the likelihood of experiencing perinatal anxiety. Fundamentally, perinatal anxiety is thought to arise from an underlying biological vulnerability paired with a stressor or trauma.
If you're interested in learning more on the pathophysiology of perinatal anxiety, there's a book called The Textbook of Women's Reproductive Mental Health, edited by Dr. Lucy Huttner and colleagues, and they go into this in greater detail. We highly recommend this book. It's written by the experts in the field, and it's very digestible for those who want additional information.
There are many different anxiety and anxiety-related disorders. Today, we are going to talk about generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and obsessive compulsive disorder. We'll also differentiate between OCD and postpartum psychosis. Before we get into diagnostic criteria, though, we're going to talk a little bit about screening.
Because the conversation around mental health and pregnancy has historically focused on postpartum depression, perinatal anxiety often goes underscreened and underrecognized. But I think we can do much better. ACOG has also recognized this aspect and the need for anxiety screening and updated their screening recommendations in June of 2023 to recommend that patients be screened for anxiety during the initial prenatal visit, later in pregnancy, and postpartum using a validated tool. An example of a validated tool for anxiety would be the Generalized Anxiety Disorder 7, also termed GAD-7, or the Perinatal Anxiety Screening Scale, also termed PASS. The GAD-7 is the more commonly used screening tool, with 7 questions and taking under 5 minutes to complete. It can also help to assess clinical symptomatology, with a score of 5 to 9 being mild, 10 to 14 being moderate, and over 15 being severe symptomatology. The EPDS, which is used primarily for depression screening, does have a subset of questions number 3 to 5, which do screen for anxiety, but it's not as robust as the GAD-7 to screen for anxiety. There are also other screeners that can be used for specific other anxiety-related disorders, such as the Perinatal Anxiety Screening Scale, which we had mentioned, as well as the Obsessive Compulsive Inventory Revised. Know that these screeners exist, but we really want you to start with something like the GAD-7 that can screen for generalized anxiety disorder, anxiety symptomatology.
Yeah, the screening tool can be really helpful to catch that anxiety might be going on, but you can't make a diagnosis off of the screening. So let's go through the diagnostic criteria.
Yeah, and that's incredibly important. Anyone who screens positive still needs evaluation by you in the clinic.
So the key feature of perinatal anxiety disorders, which are anxiety disorders that are exacerbated or occur during pregnancy or postpartum, is excessive or uncontrolled worry that has lasted at least a month and affects functioning. Similar to outside of pregnancy, the DSM-5 is utilized to make a diagnosis of anxiety during pregnancy and the postpartum period. Like Lauren said, it's important to remember that the PASS and GAD-7 are screening tools and do not provide a diagnosis. This requires a clinical assessment. Generalized anxiety disorder is categorized by excessive anxiety and worry about various topics to the point of causing functional impairment.
Joni, I feel like I have a lot of patients with anxiety. What do you consider functional impairment?
Functional impairment shows up in difficulty parenting, going to work, going to school, difficulty in your relationships. An example might be they can't shower because they're experiencing this anxiety about leaving the baby alone.
So it's something that they were able to do before that they're now no longer able to do because of their anxiety. Is that correct?
Yeah, perfect. Other symptoms experienced along with the anxiety are irritability, and this is a big one. You'll hear that one a lot. Feeling restless, keyed up, or on edge. Difficulty concentrating or their mind going blank. Sleep disturbance, particularly due to their ruminating thoughts. And muscle tension, like having headaches, neck pain, back pain, stomach pain are ones that I often hear.
I completely forgot about the DSM-5 criteria from my psychiatry rotation in medical school. It's helpful, though, to know that we use the same criteria both during pregnancy and postpartum that we do outside of the perinatal time period. I feel like I don't even have the verbiage, though, to ask about generalized anxiety disorder in clinic. How do you ask your patients about this?
2 big net questions you can use for GAD are, 1, do you consider yourself a worrier? And 2, do you worry about how much you worry? Then I go on to ask, what do you worry about? Typically, someone with GAD will say everything and will list several instances where their anxiety creeps up. Ask them about how this affects their functioning. Once these worries start to affect their ability to function at work, school, or in their relationships, have been there for over a month, and are not due to another medical condition or substance use, they likely have GAD and you will want to keep it on your differential. According to DSM criteria, you have to have these worries for at least 6 months to qualify for GAD, but we don't often have the time to wait 6 months in pregnancy when symptoms are severe. So it's reasonable to treat as GAD even if symptoms are present for a shorter interval.
So Joni, that's great for generalized anxiety disorder, but what about for panic attacks? Is that always panic disorder? Because I seem to have a lot of patients who are really anxious with that.
Yeah, good question. Panic disorder is a fear of having panic attacks. Panic attacks themselves can be a part of various anxiety or mood disorders. Panic attacks involve an abrupt surge of intense fear or discomfort, along with at least four physical symptoms like tachycardia, dizziness, sweating, chest tightness, feelings of choking, fear of dying, fear of losing control, etc. If the panic attacks are without panic disorder, treatment should focus on the initiating reason for the panic attacks, and the treatment should be the underlying anxiety disorder, which is typically therapy or an SSRI. But we'll go into more detail later.
Joni, how do you ask patients about panic attacks versus panic disorder in clinic?
Yeah, first I'll ask if they've ever even had a panic attack. I'll explain what it is. And then in patients with panic attacks, ask them when they tend to have them and if they are worried about having panic attacks. If they notice they have panic attacks doing specific activities or in certain locations, someone with panic disorder will start avoiding those locations and activities. For example, if they have panic attacks while driving on the freeway, they may start to avoid driving. We don't expect you to pinpoint all anxiety disorders for a diagnosis, but rather remember that panic attacks are often a part of other anxiety conditions and not always a diagnosis of panic disorder, unless a specific anxiety is in relationship to having panic attacks. Treating the underlying disorder will help improve panic attacks, as well as having the patient work with a therapist on mechanisms to decrease the sympathetic response and develop coping mechanisms that the patient can use to decrease panic attacks, not just during pregnancy, but in the long term as well.
That makes a lot of sense. So we've talked about generalized anxiety disorder and panic attacks, as well as panic disorder. Should we talk a little bit more about OCD and postpartum psychosis?
Yeah, that sounds great. So the prevalence of OCD is higher during reproductive transitions such as menarche, pregnancy, postpartum, and perimenopause, and it is likely underdiagnosed. Although it's not technically an anxiety disorder, it has many of the same symptoms, so it fits well within our discussion of anxiety. Postpartum psychosis is a psychiatric emergency that can sometimes be confused with OCD. We want you to be able to differentiate between these confidently.
So because OCD is a condition that can be treated with therapy and medications, and postpartum psychosis is a psychiatric emergency that can also be treated with medications but needs emergent evaluation, it's important for us to know the difference between these two.
Yeah, exactly. So let's start with OCD. OCD has the presence of both obsessions and compulsions. Obsessions are recurrent thoughts, urges, or images that they experience as intrusive and unwanted. Compulsions, on the other hand, are repetitive behaviors or even mental acts. That's important because these can be mental rituals too. A patient uses these compulsions to neutralize the anxiety brought up by the intrusive thought. Less obvious compulsions include mental review, reassurance seeking, and mental checking. Patients with OCD have thoughts that are ego dystonic, meaning they cause significant distress to them and are unwanted. It is upsetting to the patient that they are having these thoughts.
What's the opposite of ego dystonic?
The opposite would be ego syntonic, which is what occurs in individuals with postpartum psychosis. They have disturbing, intrusive thoughts, but the thoughts themselves are not bothering the patient. They may report that they are having thoughts of harming their baby and it is not distressing to them. We will discuss that more in detail.
So are all intrusive thoughts concerning?
Yeah, good question. Research shows that 70 to 100% of new mothers report intrusive thoughts of infant-related harm and approximately 50% report intrusive thoughts of harming their infant on purpose.
Wow, that's a lot of women.
Yeah, I tend to say it's pretty much everybody. Many women are intensely ashamed of these thoughts and are nervous to bring them up because they fear being reported or having their child taken away. Intrusive thoughts, particularly of harm coming to the baby, are common in the postpartum period, and although distressing to some, may not always be pathological.
What are some common intrusive thoughts that you hear?
The biggest one is the baby's not breathing, but there's a lot more that patients may not disclose to you, like they're worried about accidents like falling down the stairs, car accidents, drowning, contamination. They're really worried about their baby getting sick. They may call the pediatric office a lot. Sexual intrusive thoughts are common and are rarely brought up unless normalized and asked about. For example, while changing the baby's diaper, the parent might think, oh, did I look at my baby's penis too long? What does that mean about me? What if I molested my baby? Am I a pedophile? The response to these thoughts will help to differentiate normal from pathologic.
So if an individual has diagnostic criteria of OCD and they have intrusive thoughts and they're disturbed by them, then it's ego dystonic and more consistent with a diagnosis of OCD. Compared to if they have intrusive thoughts and they're not disturbed by them, then it's ego syntonic and important to keep postpartum psychosis on your differential diagnosis.
Yes, exactly. Postpartum psychosis, which we'll discuss in more detail in the last episode, is when a patient presents with delusions, hallucinations, confusion, thought disorganization, and bizarre behavior. They can have a depressed, manic, or mixed mood, and they tend to wax and wane. While incredibly rare, it's 1 to 2 out of 1,000 deliveries, postpartum psychosis is associated with a high risk of suicide and infanticide, and therefore is a psychiatric emergency requiring immediate assessment. A patient with postpartum psychosis has thoughts that are ego-syntonic, meaning they're in line with their current values and are not disturbing to them. They may report that they are having thoughts of harming their baby, and it is not distressing to them.
We'll go into more detail on postpartum psychosis in the next episode, but we really want you to be able to understand the difference between OCD and postpartum psychosis with ego dystonic versus ego syntonic and how to begin to develop your differential diagnosis. Joni, intrusive thoughts are so common. How do you ask about them in clinic?
I like to start by asking questions about the pregnancy or child. For example, do you ever have thoughts that scare you about your baby or about your pregnancy? What are they? And what do you do to manage those thoughts? The way they manage the thoughts will help you recognize if they are compulsing. Some examples of compulsions you may hear is checking the baby's heart rate using the Doppler multiple times, calling the pediatrician office often, researching on Google or Reddit, checking on the baby multiple times throughout the night, checking at the car seat multiple times to make sure that they're put in it properly, and not leaving the house for fear of contamination or accidents. A good question to ask when trying to determine if it is from concern for the baby or fear from OCD is what would happen if you don't do blank, like insert the compulsion here. So what would happen if you don't research on Google? If you're trying to balance your clinic time with other patients, you can utilize screeners to help you.
The examples you gave sound like all of my patients. When does checking on the baby multiple times throughout the night change into a psychiatric disorder?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when it starts to affect their ability to function, are they able to dismiss these intrusive thoughts or are they starting to change their behavior and they're not able to live their life because of these thoughts? If you're able to dismiss these thoughts, then it's not a psychiatric disorder. But if you're obsessing about them, it's starting to impact your ability to parent, be in a relationship, work, leave the house, then we might be more concerned about a psychiatric diagnosis.
I try to give patients the benefit of the doubt and ask them a few more questions about it. For example, in a patient who's telling you about the oxygen monitor that they bought for their baby, was there a concern for the baby's oxygenation? Is there a reason that they need to make sure the baby is breathing throughout the night? Did they have any lung or heart problems after delivery? Some patients may have had a real reason that they're having these compulsions, and it's logical that they're obsessing over some of the aspects. This may be something that they can target in therapy and work with a therapist on. Other patients may say, no, but I read online that babies can die in their sleep and I'm worried my baby will die in their sleep and I can't stop thinking about it. These patients may be having more difficulty broadly in assessing them for perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, specifically for either generalized anxiety disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder is important.
That's helpful.
Yeah. Why don't we review how to distinguish between generalized anxiety disorder and OCD?
Okay. To differentiate between GAD and OCD, look at the thought content. With GAD, the worries are related to real-life routine matters that bring about apprehension and thought distortions, such as catastrophizing and generalizing. The thought content tends to shift over time. For example, what if I have a C-section and have a complication and then I can't work again and I'm a bad mother? Versus OCD, the individual has intrusive, repetitive thoughts and behaviors or mental rituals that are experienced as unwanted. The obsessions tend to have stable content over time. For example, I keep seeing an image that I'm going to drop the baby down the stairs, so now I sit when I go down the stairs or I don't hold the baby at all.
That's really helpful. What about the difference between OCD and postpartum psychosis?
To differentiate between OCD and postpartum psychosis, again, You're going to assess the other symptoms the individual presents with and whether the thoughts are ego dystonic or ego syntonic. In postpartum psychosis, the patient will more likely present in a manic state with severe and dangerous delusions. Often a patient's partner or family member will call the clinic to report bizarre behavior or bring them in for evaluation because they are behaving strangely. The patient may be confused or appear similar to delirium. Remember, this is a psychiatric emergency due to the risk of suicide and infanticide. The delusional beliefs are ego syntonic, meaning in line with their current values and are experienced without insight. For example, they may say, "I'm on a special mission to save this baby, and the only option is for her to go to heaven and be protected by God." The mother likely needs urgent hospitalization, and the baby needs to be cared for by someone else. In OCD, on the other hand, concerning thoughts are often ego dystonic in nature, and the unwanted thoughts cause extreme distress. An example of OCD may be, "I keep worrying that I will stab my child with a knife, so I won't go in the kitchen anymore and I refuse to cook." The birthing individual wants to keep the baby safe, so they're acting in line with their values, but it still impacts the function of their life.
Why do I need to be able to differentiate between these disorders?
Because the treatment is different. For GAD, the mainstay of treatment is an SSRI, which we will talk about in more detail. For OCD, a particular form of psychotherapy is the most helpful, but often individuals need an SSRI as well, specifically higher doses of SSRIs. In these patients, while the thoughts may seem scary, it is not recommended to separate infants from their mothers. Contrast that with postpartum psychosis, where it is a psychiatric emergency, the individual needs to be immediately evaluated, and the infant needs to be cared for by someone else in the meantime because of the risk of infanticide.
It's helpful to have those mental health conditions on my differential in a patient who's presenting with symptoms that seem consistent with anxiety. Remember that many physiologic symptoms of pregnancy can also mimic anxiety, like an elevated resting heart rate and shortness of breath. There's also other medical conditions to think about and rule out, like common or life-threatening conditions in pregnancy or the postpartum period, such as thyroid dysfunction, anemia, intoxication, and preeclampsia. Other medical conditions that you should also think about in general for something like new-onset panic attacks are cardiovascular disease and evaluation, like if you're worried about the patient having a pulmonary embolism with shortness of breath, cardiac dysrhythmias with changes to their heart rate, obstructive sleep apnea, asthma, infection, vitamin deficiencies, and autoimmune conditions. It's important in your assessment to get a basic laboratory workup to rule out some of these common medical conditions, such as a CBC, a chemical panel, thyroid function tests, thinking about a urinalysis if you're concerned about an infection, and a urine drug screen if you're concerned about intoxication. If indicated, sometimes you might need to do a more extensive workup, like an EEG, a brain CT if you're worried about neurologic symptoms, an evaluation for infection, or a more extensive thyroid function test based on clinical presentation. After determining that these symptoms are not just physiologic symptoms of pregnancy and they're not other medical conditions, it's important to start thinking about treatment options. And to do this, it's really important to obtain a mental health history and a clinical interview as your first tool of assessment, which we reviewed in the first episode.
Okay, so treatment for perinatal GAD is similar to that for GAD in the general adult population, and luckily, it's also similar to what we discussed for perinatal depression. On obtaining current symptoms and mental health history, you'll be able to determine if they have mild, moderate, or severe symptomatology. For mild GAD, non-medication strategies are effective, including a discussion on how to improve sleep, CBT therapy, yoga, and other mindfulness practices. For moderate to severe anxiety, pharmacotherapy or medications is indicated in combination with psychotherapy.
Like the treatment for depression, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs, are the first-line agents for addressing generalized anxiety disorder in OCD. Remember, the SSRIs are sertraline, fluoxetine, escitalopram, and citalopram. And SNRIs are venlafaxine and duloxetine. There's a few other SSRIs and SNRIs that are newer, but because they haven't been researched as much, we'll focus on these ones. We often need to use SSRIs and SNRIs in higher doses for anxiety than we do for depression.
In patients with moderate to severe GAD who need medication management, use the framework we talked over in the first episode. Discuss risk of untreated illness compared to the risks of medications. We reviewed the risks of untreated illness earlier in this episode and the risks of the SSRIs and SNRIs in our first episode, so you can review them there. If you decide to start an SSRI or SNRI, utilize the patient's history to help you choose one. If they've been on one before that worked, restart that one. Otherwise, starting with a less activating SSRI, such as sertraline or escitalopram, is a great first option in a medication-naive patient. In patients with anxiety especially, it's important to set some expectations for starting these medications. Patients often have severe anxiety or psychosomatic and biological response to increases in serotonin. Talk to the patient about a possible increase in anxiety when starting the medication.
What are some things that you can do to decrease the chance of this occurring?
You can start at an even lower dose and increase it even slower. You may need to spend longer on counseling, discussing expectations, and even scheduling a follow-up to improve compliance and treatment. Reassure them that it is not uncommon for their anxiety to worsen, but it will improve in 3 to 5 days. When you are first starting the SSRI in patients with severe anxiety, you may need to start an as-needed medication for a short time until the patient is on a dose that will improve their anxiety on a daily basis. An as-needed medication would be a benzodiazepine. Hydroxyzine can be used as well, but it tends to be less effective.
Let's talk about benzodiazepines for a moment. Benzodiazepines are often either underutilized or overutilized. Historically, they were linked to cleft lip and cleft palate, but more recent large studies did not show this association. Some research has showed an increased risk of malformations in the first trimester from benzodiazepine use and SSRIs combined, but not from benzodiazepines alone. There are also some data showing an association with ectopic pregnancy and miscarriage, although these studies may be confounding by indication. Chronic benzodiazepine use in the third trimester is associated with a higher risk of small head circumference, NICU admission, and adverse delivery outcomes. Though benzodiazepines are not first-line treatment for anxiety, they can be acceptable during times such as severe insomnia, severe breakthrough anxiety, a major stressor occurring in their life, and they also may be used with severe anxiety when starting an SSRI while waiting for the SSRI to take effect. This is the most commonly used time period that I often end up utilizing them, is when I'm starting an SSRI in a severely anxious patient. They should be prescribed sparingly, temporarily, and coupled with psychotherapy and an appropriate long-term medication.
How would you actually prescribe a benzodiazepine?
Prior to starting one, I would make sure to screen for a history of substance use, make sure that the individual is in a position where sedation could not be dangerous, like if they operate heavy machinery or the only one responsible for the child overnight, and then I always discuss duration of treatment on starting them. For example, I'll say something like, "We can use a benzodiazepine for a short time period during the first month while titrating the SSRI to an effective dose. After the first month, when we're on a dose of the SSRI that is effective, we would plan to stop the benzodiazepine." Let's say a patient presents with severe anxiety or OCD and you start them on an SSRI, refer them to therapy, and discuss sleep with them. If they return or message you saying that they can't tolerate the medication, or they're not able to sleep, and it's just really worsening all of their anxiety, as long as they're not having hypomanic or manic symptoms, that it may be a time to have a risk-risk conversation about a benzodiazepine and prescribe a short-term course of this as you titrate the SSRI. A short-term course would be something like 5 to 10 tablets of 0.5 milligrams of lorazepam taken nightly. Of them, we tend to use lorazepam as the preferred medication because it has less abuse potential and a shorter half-life. A short course of lorazepam would be something like 5 to 10 tablets of 0.5 milligrams of lorazepam taken nightly while you're titrating the SSRI to a dose that's going to work for them. Prescribing benzodiazepines can be a necessary step in abating anxiety enough to allow for initiation and titration of that SSRI. It is also reasonable to use hydroxyzine in this setting if the patient declines a benzodiazepine, but remember that for really severe anxiety, it may not be enough when starting an SSRI.
So just for my understanding, who are the patients that you are prescribing benzos for because of them being highly addictive and can be problematic later on in their treatment? Who are the ones that you're opting for prescribing a benzo along with the SSRI?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to be clear, it's pretty rare that I prescribe a benzodiazepine, but in patients who are severely anxious, I prescribe one on starting the SSRI in addition to starting it low and increasing it slowly to give them some aspect of relief in that first month while we're waiting for the SSRI to work and while we're slowly titrating it up. Otherwise, patients who are anxious, who have more anxiety symptoms on starting an SSRI, I try and have them either decrease the dose or give it a little bit longer to see if some of those anxiety symptoms abate. The other aspect is if a patient's not tolerating an SSRI, it's okay to switch them to a different one. But if you think that the reason they're not tolerating it is due to the initial reaction of the increase in serotonin, that you could either try starting even lower than what you started at or keeping them on that lower dose for even longer. Or if it's just really not working and it's been a month, or especially if it's been 2 months, you could also consider switching them to a different SSRI.
Risks to discuss with a patient on using a benzo are sedation, increased risk of NICU admission if used in late pregnancy, and neonatal respiratory suppression with high continuous doses. Taking a benzodiazepine 2 to 3 times daily would be considered a high continuous dose. If they are breastfeeding, a small amount of lorazepam is found in breast milk, so be sure to counsel the patient on watching the newborn for sleepiness, low energy, or poor suck. Remember to balance the risk of untreated severe anxiety and the risk of the patient not tolerating the SSRI you are starting. Be sure to set expectations on starting it that you're only going to be using it during the first month as you titrate the SSRI to a level that starts to work.
Why are we so careful with benzodiazepines?
As is well known, we must be careful with the use of benzos due to addiction, tolerance, and diversion. Using short-term purposeful prescriptions that are monitored can be a low-risk way of bridging patients to a better treatment, such as a high-dose SSRI. Providing a small supply of medication, 10 or fewer tablets, ensures that the provider is contacted prior to chronic use.
So, Joni, it sounds like using a benzodiazepine and it's not a long-term solution, but really what you want is the SSRI for a long-term solution, and then only using the benzodiazepine if needed in severe anxiety with a set expectation of when you're stopping it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the goal.
Can you use benzodiazepines in other anxiety disorders?
So benzodiazepines can't be used for all anxiety disorders. For other anxiety-related disorders, specifically PTSD, a benzodiazepine can actually inhibit improvement. The mainstay of treatment for PTSD is therapy, and while concurrent SSRI use may be helpful, giving a benzo will inhibit new memory formation during therapy and be counterproductive for those patients. Some other considerations for benzodiazepines. One, though lorazepam is preferred, do not switch medications in a pregnant patient who is already taking an effective benzodiazepine. This would be an additional exposure to the fetus. Two, discuss a plan for infant care if a patient is taking benzos for insomnia. The patient will need assistance as their alertness may be impaired. Three, if benzos are taken scheduled for a prolonged time, they need to be tapered off slowly. Do not abruptly stop them as this risks serious complications from withdrawal. And four, make a referral if benzos are required for more than just brief short-term treatment.
So we've talked about the treatment for generalized anxiety disorder, and it sounds like the treatment for PTSD is referral for therapy. How do you treat OCD?
For OCD, pharmacotherapy is also recommended and is similar to GAD. Recommended first-line agents for perinatal OCD are SSRIs. I like to start sertraline if they haven't tried it previously because it works on a receptor called sigma, which specifically helps with ruminating thoughts. Treatment for OCD typically requires a higher dose of medication, which can even be well past the FDA max. For example, for GAD, you may prescribe sertraline between 100 and 200 milligrams, while for OCD, you may prescribe 200 to 400 milligrams.
And for sertraline, what is the FDA max?
200 milligrams.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. And then therapy is essential in treating those with OCD, specifically a branch of CBT called exposure and response prevention, or ERP. The whole idea behind ERP is to expose the individuals to the topics that cause anxiety and prevent themselves from doing the compulsion that helps them feel better. By interrupting the anxiety and OCD cycle, their brain begins to learn that they can tolerate uncertainty, which is at the root of OCD. For this reason, OCD is referred to as the doubting disorder. In Utah, we have a new intensive outpatient program for postpartum women that specifically uses ERP at a group practice called Serenity Recovery and Wellness, which is in Riverton and Provo. Many other perinatal therapists have started to be trained in ERP because it is the gold standard treatment for those with OCD and can be used for GAD and panic disorder as well. Postpartum Support International has a specific OCD virtual group therapy, and the International OCD Foundation, or IOCDF, has a therapist locator for people who practice ERP. We'll link these resources in the show notes.
Let's wrap up the episode by talking about tips and tricks specifically for SSRIs for anxiety in the perinatal period. SSRIs are the mainstay of treatment. Follow similar principles for discussing treatment options as you do for patients with depression. You may want to start an even lower dose of the SSRI and increase even slower than you would for depression. For example, 25 milligrams of sertraline for 1 or 2 full weeks before increasing to 50 milligrams of sertraline. You often need to spend a longer time counseling on side effects because of the nature of the anxiety with these patients. Consider an anxiolytic during the first 2 to 4 weeks of starting an SSRI in severe anxiety. This would be something like lorazepam with adequate counseling expectations and giving them a limited supply. If they decline a benzodiazepine, you can think about using hydroxyzine, although it's not as effective. Patients may need a sooner follow-up, such as in 2 weeks instead of 4 weeks, to review their side effects, provide reassurance, and encourage them to continue the medication. Sometimes you can either call the patient yourself or have a staff member call the patient to check in on them on that time period. In patients with OCD, higher doses of SSRIs are often needed, coinciding with therapy, specifically ERP. Patients whose anxiety is not improving, who continue to need additional prescriptions of a benzodiazepine, or with OCD requiring high doses of SSRIs above the FDA recommendations, which was over 200 milligrams of sertraline, should be referred to a psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner for continued care.
In terms of resources, we discussed our favorite resources in our first episode, like PSI, MGH, Lifeline for Moms, NCRP, for additional provider education and patient resources. We also discussed how to find referrals for patients in your area in our first episode, and we'll send you to that episode to learn more. Okay, so key clinical points. A few concise questions can help to identify anxiety disorders. Anxiety symptomatology becomes abnormal when it affects function. Obsessive thoughts should be explored and not assumed to be a risk to the infant.
Patients with perinatal OCD have ego dystonic thoughts, meaning if they are having obsessive thoughts of hurting the baby, the thoughts are disturbing to them. This is different than postpartum psychosis, which is a psychiatric emergency, where the thoughts are ego syntonic, meaning they are in line with their values and therefore not upsetting to the patient. Treatment of anxiety disorders is similar to that for depression, recommending sleep, exercise, and healthy eating as self-care components is integral to improved mood. Therapy is a mainstay of treatment for anxiety. Patients with OCD and PTSD will need more specialized therapy to adequately treat the disorder.
Pharmacotherapy, when recommended, is SSRIs. Start even lower and increase even slower. Some patients may need an anxiolytic on initiation. You can start treatment and refer to specialists in patients who are not improving, who are requiring continued anxiolytics, or who are needing higher doses of SSRIs. And that wraps up our episode on perinatal anxiety. Thanks for joining us today on the NCRP XOB PMADS podcast series. On the next episode, we'll talk about suicide and crisis situations. We'll see you there.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.